Donald on the Kitchen talks about food. Donald on the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald on the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintos.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we come to you from the studios of KHOI Community Radio right here in Ames, Iowa, the center of Ames, the center of Iowa, the center of it all. Donna, it's snowing. It's April and it's snowing.
Oh, hush. I want it over with already.
We've had ups and downs.
It should have come yesterday for April Fool's Day or something.
Oh, it should have. Yes. And it didn't. So we've survived Easter. We have survived April Fool's Day. We have to get through this snow. And I managed to get through Easter and the Donna Lana Kitchen show this year. No bunny jokes this year, Donna.
I know. We forgot your dumb bunny jokes.
We forgot the dumb bunny jokes. We have a whole stash of them. We'll save them for the
future. Lana's really good at the delivery of bunny jokes, right?
Gotta have a specialty. But in honor of spring and in honor of bunnies in general, I would like to report a friend of mine from Des Moines, a fellow gardener, told me that really, truly, she fell down a rabbit hole a couple weeks ago.
No drugs needed.
She's a gardener.
No Alice in Wonderland.
She was
no.
out there. And the
well,
old...
did she say if she saw the white rabbit?
No,
oh,
no. She
bummer.
Just saw a lot of pain because it, like, screwed up her knee. So I wish her recovery from falling down that
it's
rabbit
true.
Hole.
True. They do make these odd... I found an... a nest of baby bunnies right in the middle of my lawn last year. It was so shallow, I moved a bunch of leaves, and out came these, like, 3-inch baby bunnies all over the place. And I guess I was glad I didn't step in that hole.
Ha! But this is good. So look out, gardeners out there. It's dangerous out there if you can fall down holes. So be careful. Oh, and also, because it's spring, I wish to do a small salute to snakes, Donna. Snakes are waking up this time of year. Over this
well, and here in Iowa, that's not such a problem because we have adorable snakes, very few venomous ones, and it's kind of fun.
Right. I sort of have learned to appreciate them. This weekend, we had some trees cut down on our place, and so I was moving brush. I sort of like to move brush, tidying up the yard there, dragging all those.
Oh, I'm going to invite you over.
I can do that. You know, as long as I don't have to run the chainsaw, I'm doing good. So I'm taking all these sticks and dragging big branches and tops of trees to a big pile that will probably be a solstice burn pile, perhaps, in the middle of our field. But on my way, I kept noticing the grass was moving as I was going toward the brush pile there, and snakes. Now, I'm used to seeing a snake or two in the garden, and I walk back and forth across this sunny spot in the grass, 10 or 12 times, and each time it was like 2 snakes, 5 snakes, 6 snakes. They just kind of boiled out of there. And you could tell they were kind of small and not too big yet.
Like a foot long.
Yeah, a foot long. And they're just gorgeous things. And I was...
What are they, garter snakes?
I looked it up.
Tell us what they look like.
They are very pretty, very pretty brown and had a lighter tan yellowish stripe all the way down on the side of them and sort of greenish yellowish stripe on down each side. I think they are the plains garter snake. Garter snake is kind of a catch-all term because there are 4 kinds of garter snakes that make Iowa home. Eastern garter snake, red-sided garter snake, the western ribbon snake, and the plains garter snake. So I looked it up. I think it's a plains garter snake. And I was actually kind of pleased to see them. And like you said, ever since I learned there's no poison snakes in Iowa, unless you go up maybe up by the Mississippi River. But so I've learned to enjoy them, and they were obviously waking up. Maybe it was a whole nest of them out for their first run.
Right. they what, lay eggs and then hatch out or something? I mean, as soon as garter snake in my brain, it takes me back to in seventh grade, we had a terrarium in biology class where they brought in a lot of, I mean, maybe there were five or six little snakes and they let us play with them.
Of course,
I loved playing with the snakes. All the other girls were screaming, so I loved it even more. because they are adorable and they kind of, you know, roll around in your hands and climb over your fingers.
I think the word graceful is they're
that's true. That's a very good description.
But I have never seen them in quite the quantity that I saw.
Must have been a nest.
I guess I really appreciated them because as I was walking through the grass, these tens of a dozen or so that I saw, they were all scurrying away from me. If that many snakes were scurrying toward me, I would have been a little more upset. But welcome spring, welcome garter snakes, and
I suspect that's a sign of a healthy ecosystem.
Oh yeah. I hope so. It says they like to be near water. They eat earthworms, slugs, small amphibians, but these were way too small to eat. To eat small mammals and birds. They'd have to be pretty big for that. But they could. So, I'm glad there's snakes there. And like I said, I'm glad they were hightailing it away from me at the time. Happy spring, Donna. Good. So, we're talking about things to do with spring. And we just haven't done recipes for a while. So, Donna, what do you have for us today?
Well, we thought we would talk about eggs. Eggs seem to be, of course, an Easter thing, and right about now, some of us may be looking at piles of leftover hard-boiled Easter eggs. What are you going to do? This is what I love about eggs. It is the neatest pack of protein for human consumption. The amino acid profile, that's the protein building blocks of an egg, are the most perfect for the needs of the human body. So an egg is like nature's perfect food. And of course, we have lived through times when eggs were like, oh no, you can't eat eggs, it's too much cholesterol, blah, 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 blah. And then some of that has been revisited and found to be not so appropriate because after all, it is not only is it a really good, healthy source of protein, it is a not terribly expensive source of protein compared to other ones. So eggs are, having too many eggs is a delight, I would say. I'm thinking, of course, I love egg salad sandwich, right?
You can
flavor that a lot. What's the typical mayonnaise, salt, pepper, maybe a little mustard if you go that way. You can chop fresh herbs into it. People put very finely diced celery, or you could put finely diced fennel. You can just go nuts with egg salad.
Pickles. I like to do pickles.
That's right. That's a classic, too. And speaking of pickles, we haven't talked about pickled eggs for a long time. I wanted to ask you because Lana has her own chickens, so obviously she has very fresh eggs all the time. Now, if you're making hard-boiled eggs, you want to use slightly older eggs because if they're too fresh, it's really a pain to get the shell off. You know, it breaks into little pieces and then, I'm thrilled with the hard-boiled egg when you just crack that end where the air bubble is and the whole thing kind of slips off. Then that's like, oh, I'm good. But when you have to pick all the little pieces of the shell off, it's really annoying. So, what is your trick, Lana?
Well, yes, those fresh eggs, there's a lot of stuff inside that egg, and they lose as they get older and older and older.
As the eggs get older and older. Like we're talking a week or so.
They start losing some moisture that actually can go through the shell.
Right.
But that helps you able to peel it because otherwise the inside of the egg is smashed right up against the shell. So I want, if I'm going to do some hard-boiled eggs, and I like to make egg salad, too, I keep track of when I have harvested eggs recently and keep some older ones to boil. If I have to, I could leave a couple eggs out on the counter for, I mean, if they're just fresh under the chicken, from under the chicken, I'd say let them sit out for 5 days, a week. Eggs out on the counter really, truly, unless it's, 102 in the shade, eggs are going to be just fine. And that helps to age them a little bit if you're going to hard-boil them.
This is a very American thing about keeping the eggs in the refrigerator. Many, many cultures, and many of them even, like when I was in New Zealand, everybody leaves their eggs out. You don't put the eggs in the refrigerator. So it's really not necessary. And I have heard, this is just hearsay, mind you, that when you buy eggs in the supermarket, they can be as old as 6 months old. That sounds a little extreme, but knowing our distribution system and how far things go, it's not impossible.
Well, that's hats off to chickens and eggs, because really, truly, they do store well. I don't know about 6 months, but yeah, right. they do last right. a long time. And just think about it. An egg is meant to be laid and sit under a chicken for, 28, 29 days?
Before it hatches. To incubate, right.
It's amazing. Chickens and eggs are good. Yeah.
So anyway, for hard-boiled eggs, if you're starting from scratch, you don't want to use those super, super fresh eggs because they will be annoying to peel. And there are multiple ways of, how do you do your hard-boiled eggs? Do you remember? I look it up every time. Something, I think there was a method that I tried recently that was, you put them in tap water, room temperature, and then you bring them to boil and let them boil, I don't know, 5 minutes or something? I don't remember.
Yeah, I am.
What's your...
I don't like to drop eggs into boiling water. You're going to crack them
that
way.
That's right.
So I start them, too, with just tap water, room temperature water. Bring that to a boil. I bring it to a full boil for, or a good, not hard boil, a boil for a minute, then put the cover on and let it sit for about 10 minutes.
Oh, that's how you do it. Okay.
And in a sense, it mm-hmm. keeps on cooking, but I do it that way because it's a good way for me to remember to time it. I'm not going to stand there watching my eggs boil. So I just, there, okay, minute, that sounds good. Let's just cover them up there and forget them. There. Remember, don't put them in boiling water. It does crack.
And then they kind of splurge out and get, that's annoying too. So pickled eggs, there's a recipe where you put, so you take the hard boiled eggs, you peel them, then you put them in, let's pull this recipe up. This is the New York Times. So this calls for, this is the one where they put some beets in it so that you end up with pink pickled eggs. So they use a can of beets, cup of white distilled vinegar, a third of a cup of sugar, tablespoon of salt. That's for 6 eggs peeled. They also put in a shallot and 3 sprigs of dill and peppercorns. Oh, and a quarter teaspoon of whole cloves, says optional. So you let them sit there. How long does it say? Store in the fridge for up to a week before removing from the brine.
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
Right. Do you put, is this brine put on, okay.
Peeled.
On peeled eggs.
Yeah.
And is it hot brine or not hot brine?
All right.
Probably not hot. You don't want to cook the eggs again.
No, turn off the heat and cool for 30 minutes. Once cooled, pour the pickling liquid over the top and cover tightly with the lid. Pickle in the refrigerator for at least 24 hours and up to 1 week. Then remove the eggs and beets from the brine and store in the fridge for another week if you'd like to. So there's that. Pickled beets, and then of course there's deviled eggs.
Oh, I love deviled eggs.
And you can do, I remember as a kid, I would always, You know, after a while you get tired of eating the whites and you just want the deviled egg part, sort of. I think when my mother wasn't looking, I would sort of lick the yolk stuck.
Oh, Donna.
I know. I was a terrible child. I love that. I love egg. I still love egg yolks. They're one of the most unctuous things you can eat. They're just so delicious. I am not one of these egg white omelet people, however. I can't think of anything more ridiculous. anyway, just a personal thing. So lots of deviled eggs, different kinds of egg salads. You can get quite creative in your, like, curried egg salad. Or now, the other thing that I like to do, and this isn't duck eggs. Make wonderful, let's see, what did I do 1 year? Okay, so the duck eggs have a really hard shell, you know, much harder than a chicken egg. So you kind of use, you can, if you're careful, you can use a knife and, you know, end up with two little cups, basically, because the shells don't break that much. And then one time I was serving, and it was this time of year, and we wanted local foods. I think it was when Dan Barber came to town, right? Do you remember that dinner?
Oh, my. Yes, yeah, a right. Big deal.
So here I am. It's like April 3rd, and, you know, the biggest hot deal chef in the country is coming to town, and he's the poster child for farm-to-table local foods. And, of course, it's April. What do we have in April in Iowa? Oh, very little. I think we foraged a salad of wild mustard greens, mm-hmm. and I think you picked me a lot of those things. So we had a salad. One of the things that I did was I took these duck eggs and I made some kind of egg salad with the duck's eggs, and then I served it with little dimitas spoons in the half of the duck egg. Because it was like a buffet, you know, for a little.
Well, I hope he was impressed.
Oh, he did make a comment, though, on our, we had early morning harvest polenta. And I was serving that actually in the pot at the stove. And he was standing there kind of puzzling over it. And he said, damn, I just can't get polenta this good. And I went, yeah, well, we're in the middle of the corn belt here, you know. And he said, what variety of this corn is this? And I said, well, I don't know, but I'll ask the farmer. So when I asked Earl, you know, I expected him to say, oh, well, it's yellow, blah, blah, number, blah, 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 whatever. And it is organically grown. But Earl said to me, well, I just walk through the fields and I save, you know, I pick the cobs that are appeal to me visually and I save the ones the kernels that I think are the most beautiful. So it's just was a personal selection that Earl Hafner was doing on his corn polenta, but it did catch the attention of Dan Barber. So anyway, eggs. Back to eggs. Now, another thing that I like to do with eggs is, it started with years ago in Mexico, you go down there and you eat huevos rancheros, right? Which is ranch eggs. But what it is basically is they've got some sort of red bean and tomato mixture, and sometimes it has beef in it or pork or something else. But it's kind of soupy, and then of course you heat it up, and then you make little pockets where you crack the eggs on the top, and then you snap a lid on it and you let them poach. Now, that's wonderful by itself, eaten with tortillas, but there are all kinds of other, like, leftover soupy-ish, well, more like stew, you know, where you let the egg cook in something that you've heated up, whether it's, you know, like a beef stew or potato dishes. There's just so many things that having a fresh egg, and you only want to, well, it's up to you, but I like it so the yolk is still runny.
I do too, yeah. And I live with someone who would run and hide if an egg looked like it was runny.
Yes, it's a personal choice.
It's a personal choice. I like runny. Yeah. So poached eggs are lovely.
Yeah, slow, poached eggs slow on cooking. Something.
Right. Oh yeah. Leftover grains, if you have some...
Oh, like even fried rice or noodle
fried
dishes
rice,
or
noodles,
anything
yeah.
that you have to...
Buckwheat, yeah.
It has to be a little wet, yeah, which is, yeah. I mean, we even can. You can, you know, I do not use a microwave at my house. I do not have one. And but most things are very easy to heat up. If you take a saucepan, put whatever the leftover is, add a little bit of water so there's some moisture to heat up. So, and that would be true if you were going to put eggs on it. Just have enough liquid in it, whether it's stock or water or whatever, that it's going to come up and steam the eggs. So that's another, you know, that to me, eggs are not always breakfast, you know.
No, no. Right.
That to me is a good supper.
That's good.
Yeah. The other thing that I love to do with eggs, and this was a recipe that I just got straight out of the New York Times. It's called the crustless egg and cheese quiche. So what I love about it is it's crustless. There's two reasons I love that. A, it's a lot less caloric, and B, you don't have to make a crust. So you just take, you know, your baking pan, whatever, Pyrex-y thing, you butter the bottom, and you sprinkle some breadcrumbs on it. Then you mix, let's see, 2 tablespoons, yeah, grease the pan. Then, and not a lot of breadcrumbs, only a tablespoon, just a little bit. Then you have this. Now, this version was cheese and mushrooms, but I've done it with all kinds of just lightly cooked vegetables. This one called for 2 cups of mushrooms to be sautéed first, and 1 cup of grated cheese, such as Gruyere, Emmentaler, or cheddar, so any kind of cheese. 1 cup of half and half or heavy cream, and 1 cup of milk. Wow. So there's 2 cups of dairy, 4 eggs... And then whatever cheese and flavorings, you know, salt, pepper, et cetera, et cetera. And then for this recipe, they mix all of that together, pour it into the pan that already has the breadcrumbs and butter on the bottom. And then they added some quarter cup Parmesan on top. But, you know, you can vary the ingredients so much. It takes a 325 degree oven. 8-inch round, square, or oval casserole, and then you cook it about 40 to 45 minutes. And then you want it to still be a little wobbly in the center, so then you just take it out and, you know, let it come to room temperature that way.
Yum.
Yeah, and so it's really easy.
What a nice way to have an easy breakfast. I would probably add onions to that quiche, because I add onions to eggs quite often.
Yeah, you know, any vegetable combination. And once you've cooked it, you know, it can also just sit in the refrigerator, and then you can have a slice for lunch. And it's actually like quiche. It's good warmed up, but it's not bad at room temperature either. You know, it's just it's a dish I like to cook, especially if I'm only cooking for myself. I'll make one and eat it over several meals. And then, of course, you know, you don't get bored with it, because you can vary the flavor any old way you want. So,
yes.
So, eggs. We like eggs.
We like eggs. And 3 cheers to chickens. I wish to, besides talking about snakes today, the chickens on my farm do their hard work.
Do chickens try to eat snakes, or that's beyond their... it's too big for them?
I don't think... Well, I think they would be interested, and they'd love to eat one if they could catch one, but I don't think they could catch one. I mean, they're
a snake is not exactly a large worm.
No,
so,
no. Right. They're busy enjoying spring right now and pecking around. And I've seen them after such a dry, awful... spring, not awful, but very dry spring, they're scratching away and there's not much there. But after a little moisture in the ground and the absolute joy of a chicken pulling up their first
juicy worm, right?
Oh, the first, yeah. The early bird gets the early worm. Yes, they do, every single time. All right. You're listening to KHOI, and this is the Donalana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lena Kitchen. Donna and I are sitting here around our kitchen table talking about eggs. And another thing you can do with eggs is, good heavens, you can bake. I love to bake. And I got a hankering, as one gets a hankering every now and then, for some gingerbread.
Right. That is a specific thing that you're, yeah. Right.
The hanker or the gingerbread?
The hanker for gingerbread.
Yeah,
I would say, right. It's not that common anymore. I mean, for example, everybody used to, my grandmother's main cookie, which she always had, were ginger cookies. We used to always have something more gingery around than we do these days. So
yeah, that's true. I think we're thinking more about flavor. Maybe Christmas we get the ginger
right.
out. But no, every now and then it's a... And I've tried a number of different gingerbread recipes, but I think I've hit upon a winner here. There's a big variation on how they work.
Oh, this is a deep gingerbread.
Yes,
I tasted
yes.
it. It's really, really something.
I got out a recipe book that I've been kind of enjoying before. We talked about this recipe book before. The recipe book is called Jubilee, Recipes from 2 Centuries of African-American Cooking by Tony Tipton Martin. And there's a gingerbread recipe in here, and she always has little things to say besides just the recipe. Spice cakes, she says. Spice cakes were a amazingly versatile mm-hmm. kind of thing because it could be very, very egg and butter rich or not. If you spiced it up, you could just about do anything. And this recipe is called gingerbread with lemon sauce, of all things. And what she says about this is that it's kind of, she did a lot of historical research. And evidently Booker T. Washington writes about spending 9 years of his life, when he didn't really want to be spending 9 years of his life, on a tobacco plantation in Virginia. And the ladies of the house would have gingerbread with lemon sauce. And he swore that when he gained his freedom, he would have gingerbread whenever he wanted. I hope he got to do that because I'm sure the gingerbread that got served to the plantation owners was probably a bit more rich than the stuff that the help was being served or had to make for themselves. But anyway, I found this gingerbread recipe to be very delicate and cake-like. And like Donna said,
right, lovely texture. Oh, the flavor was
just intense.
Right, because it uses blackstrap molasses, which is very strongly flavored.
Very strong. It's amazing. You start out with 2.5 cups flour, 2 teaspoons baking powder, 1 teaspoon baking soda, 1/2 teaspoon salt, ginger, cinnamon, cloves. Okay, mix that stuff.
So powdered ginger.
Powdered,
yeah.
This is powdered ginger. And I tended to go pretty intense on these spices like I always do. They ask for 2.5 to 1 teaspoon of each, okay? And you fluff that all together and you beat 1 stick of melted butter, 1/2 cup dark brown sugar, and 2 large eggs. Beat that
into a flour. Okay, so not only blackstrap, but dark brown sugar.
Yeah.
Which has also a higher molasses content.
Oh, it was lovely.
Yeah.
Okay, beat that up until it's kind of fluffy like you do with eggs and sugar. And then this is what really gets you. 1 cup molasses and 1 cup boiling strong hot coffee.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So
does that call for blackstrap molasses, or you just did blackstrap molasses?
I just did blackstrap molasses.
All right. So that is a... But we'll call that a Lana innovation.
The coffee kind of added to it.
Yes.
I made sure that was strong, too. I like strong coffee. So all of that gets mixed together. I was surprised at how watery this. I mean,
that's how you ended up with a light and fluffy gingerbread.
Yeah, light and fluffy. It doesn't have any milk in it.
Uh-huh.
And butter, and it pours into a 9 by 13 pan, greased. And it really was a nice, like you said, intensely gingerbread. And the recipe was from Toni Tipton Martin from her book Jubilee. And then the idea of covering it with a lemon sauce. Now, I made this lemon sauce and put it over the top of some of the cake as I was cutting it. And somehow I couldn't get my mind around lemon and ginger. I mean, I like the gingerbread just like it was, because also you could serve it with whipped cream, which I sort of did. I saved some and put
right. I like gingerbread with
whipped cream
or sweetened sour cream or something like so that. But this lemon sauce, so it's sugar, cornstarch, water, butter, grated juice, and zest. And this looks a little bit like what I call hard sauce. Mm-hmm. Now, I make that, only I add bourbon to it, with the Christmas pudding, with my grandmother Baumgartner's Christmas pudding recipe, which is another form of a
spice cake
now, kind of.
Yeah.
And so I can see where that would work.
Yeah, it was, you know, I could see how it worked, but I guess I was just not in the mood for lemon on top of my gingerbread, so I just enjoyed my gingerbread. I'll save the lemon sauce for
something
else. Well,
she does, in the cookbook, she does offer an alternative, which she calls bourbon chantilly cream, which is basically whipped cream with bourbon in it. That sounds really good.
That sounds, and one cup of heavy whipping cream, and 2 teaspoons of powdered sugar mm-hmm. to kind of firm it up, and then mm-hmm. 2 teaspoons of bourbon. I did something sort of like that, and it was good. So I got my gingerbread fix for a while. That's a good thing to do. Yes, it is.
Well, this is a season where although I had some asparagus this week, that's the first sign of spring. Well, it's in all the stores now, and probably coming up from the south.
Although there are things popping up in my garden, just barely.
Right.
We got
nothing yet, really. I mean, the motherwort is out, and the garlic chives, and that's about it. So, yeah. So,
but the first asparagus, even if it did have to travel a ways.
Yeah, it was very welcome, I must say.
Oh, very good. All right. Well, we have a news item. Tick a tick tick a tick tick a tick tick a tick tick
a
tick.
A real bummer news item here.
Well, of course it's a bummer news, but we should know these things, and it has been in the news, and.
Yeah, Iowa made the national news with this one. That's how bad it was.
Yeah, this is, we
screwed up this time. We got Caitlin Clark going on, hallelujah, right? But then Iowa also made the news with this one.
3 million pounds, 265,000 gallons of liquid fertilizer was released between March 9th and 10th.
Accidentally.
From the new cooperative facility, a farm co-op, in Red Oak, Iowa, southwestern Iowa, into the East Nishnabotna River.
I'm not even going to try to say that. So
I've been trying to say Nishnabotna River, and you don't get to say that often. Into the East Nishnabotna River, essentially sterilizing the 60 miles of a
sterilized river in southeast Iowa. Sterilized river. I mean, everything is dead.
This is not good, folks. 60 miles between Red Oak, the town of Red Oak, and the Missouri River.
Right, and when it emptied into the Missouri, obviously a larger river, it got diluted enough that it didn't make a total fish kill. But, you know, it kept traveling all the way along the Missouri River and then into the Mississippi River and then on,
This is not, and just how toxic that stuff was. It just didn't make the fish sick. This is like dead. Like many dead things. And heaven knows what other things
did. The little fish, everything.
And there's turtles, frogs, and anything that might have been sleeping along there. Yeah. And talk about a mess. I don't know if that's cleanupable or what is going to happen, but the Nishnabotna River, which I used to think was the prettiest name for a river, it's in trouble now, so we wish it the best this spring. I was reading a article by Chris Jones. He's a water expert retired from the University of Iowa.
We think he got retired because he was speaking out, saying things that
his employers did not want to hear.
Yeah, he's very concerned about the waters of Iowa, and naturally,
and
he had
so, as far
lots
as I'm
of
concerned,
things
yeah.
to say about that too.
What's the name of his book? The Swine Republic, right?
Yeah, that's in our
really
water,
really a
too.
Good read.
That's in our water, too. Mm-hmm. So he has lots to say. In his article that he was talking about this fish kill and this poisoning of the river, he kind of gives us an idea of what land drains into the Mississippi River. About the eastern...
No, the Missouri River.
Well, okay. In the Missouri River. The Missouri River actually has kind of an area that is about, think of the state of Iowa, and the western third, and that goes clear out to in the west and clear up the Missouri River. That's the Missouri River drainage, and then everything sort of two-thirds of Iowa to the east is the Mississippi
directly
River.
Directly into the Mississippi.
Yeah, directly into Mississippi. So we are connected to a lot of things, and just kind of being aware of where our water comes from, where it goes, and heaven knows how they're going to clean this up. I have no idea. We'll try to keep you informed here. And also, Chris Jones talks about the not-so-good practice of that Iowa farmers and Iowa land people did in past generations of straightening rivers to drain land for agriculture. Maybe fine for agriculture, but it has really done a job on our rivers. Not so good. Not so good.
Right. Those are called, when the river kind of meanders, it's called an oxbow. Mm-hmm. And the oxbow is really good to help the water kind of filter through some of the prairie lands and take out, first of all, so there's not so much sediment in rivers. So during mostly the 30s and things like that, there was probably the Army Corps of Engineers had a lot to do with this.
Yeah.
A lot of rivers in the Midwest were straightened. It means mm-hmm. they came in with big dredgers and diggers, and they made those rivers straight so that more corn and other things could be planted, you know, because in the meander, you lose a lot of square footage of fields and things like that. So they straightened the rivers, and it wasn't the smartest thing human beings have ever done. It caused a lot of things that were unforeseen, let's say, you know, like that the rivers started, you know, carrying more erosion. They moved faster. They didn't filter and perk the water in the same way. It changed a lot of things here in Iowa and other Midwestern states, too.
Ha. So this news item from the Dandelion Kitchen is a bummer news item because we're talking about, as of now, they estimate that 750,000 fish were killed. Not so good.
And that's... only one of the consequences.
Right, right. Maybe that's the ones that are just floating belly up. Not so good.
Yeah.
Not so good. Oh, also I want to mention, I read this article by Chris Jones. You can read a lot of other articles by Iowa authors. There is a Substack on that you can get access to called the Iowa Writers Collaborative. And there's a whole list of interesting things.
Lots of people all writing about things in Iowa. Some of it's this environmental stuff. Mary Swander writes on it. She writes great short stories. There's political stuff on there. And it's on a thing called Substack.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is, but you can go to...
Well, I don't know exactly. I'm on their list. I don't know how I got there, but it's really... It wasn't hard, apparently, if I could do it on the internet. And you can, you know, you don't have to pay anything. But if you want to support the writers, you can then get more of their work with some paid content in addition. So it's a pretty nifty thing.
Yes. So three cheers for all the writers.
Wait, it's called the Iowa...
Writers Collaborative.
Iowa Writers Collaborative. Maybe if you Google that, you'll find it
that
way.
I bet you'll find it there.
Yeah.
That's good. This is KHOI. And this is the Donna Lena Kitchen. You can find out more about this fine radio station. And you can find out more about the Donna Lena Kitchen by going to www.khoifm.org. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lena Kitchen. So we've been talking about spring things and eggs and the Nishnabotna River. I wish to extend a correction about the Donna Lena Kitchen. I gave some information last week. See, last week, I don't know what we were talking about, but Donna turns to me and she says, so, what about walking onions for the garden? And
We were talking about what's sprouted out of the ground already. And,
yep. Yeah.
And some of those onions are popping
coming up. And so she said, what about walking? And my mind just totally blanked, and so I just kept kind of blathering as I do
Is our ad-lib nature here.
Yeah, that's good, and yeah, I know I could see them in my brain, and I could talk about them. Yes, they're poking out of the ground, but it's not walking onions. There's something called walking garlic officially. There's a lot of names for things, but what I was thinking of and what I have in my garden is something called Welsh onions. Welsh, like the country, like the corgi, Welsh onions. And it is a perennial onion that comes up not only from whatever little bits you leave in the ground, which I tend to do each year, and it comes up as a bunch of onions on underneath the ground, but it is one of the first green things to come up, big, fat, greenish, large chive-looking leaves.
Right, but they're not chives. They're scallion size at least.
Yeah, scallion size. And the bulbs underneath are large. I've never had them like turn into bulbed onions, but they're nice. Large.
Oh, do you dig the whole onion up?
Oh yeah, yeah. I always make sure to leave a little onion underneath to keep coming next year, because they seem to grow like crazy, and you want to put them in a place in your garden where you don't mind that they're kind of tall, and they do self-seed like crazy.
Yeah, it's a little random, but I love any of these things that you just put it in, and it keeps coming every year, you know, no effort on my part.
Wow, yes, right. So, that's Welsh onions. So, if you want to get them in your garden, it's a nice thing. Oh, they're very pretty. They put up a nice poofy allium sort of flower.
So is this something you originally started from seed and they just keep going and going?
Yes.
Okay.
You know, I go through the seed catalog and
it be listed as a perennial then in the seed catalogs?
Probably just under onions or probably under specialty herbs because it'd be like where chives are listed. They're like chives on steroids.
Yeah.
That's good. Oh, I found something about onions in general. Do you know India is one of the world's biggest producers of onions and the world's biggest producer of vegetables in general. They export a lot of vegetables.
Well, it is one of the largest nations that has a very large, big vegetarian population.
And what better to start any kind of cooking than onions? This may be a political thing, but India is banning the export of onions, and I'm not quite sure whether they are running out of onions or they want to control the market, because for much of the world, at least on the other side of the globe, Bangladesh, Malaysia, United Arab Emirates, a lot of folks, they rely on India for their vegetables. And there's interesting things going on over there. Onion prices are going up and down and up and down. I don't know if it's going to affect onions here, but I've got my onions in the ground.
Well, it could be. And this is a speculation because I haven't done the research, but like many places, I think there has been some drought in India, which means maybe a smaller onion harvest. And it is, I think, also an election year over there. So
funny
just
about
like
that.
Over here, we want to, you know, make sure it's a famous thing to always have bread available during election cycles. But I would suspect having a shortage of onions in India with an electorate would be not very popular. Kind of like high gas prices here are not very popular during
used
election
cycles.
Used
to be chicken in every pot, but I suppose in India it would be an onion in every pot.
A few onions in every pot,
so,
yeah.
So, think about that. Onions in general, and Welsh onions, too. So, and like I mentioned, those are perennial. If you take care of them a little bit, you'll see them each year. Another little garden thing here. I want to mention a plant that I discovered about 2 years ago, and I have been overly pleased with it. Of all things, it is called perpetual spinach. Now, that doesn't even sound very good, does it? Perpetual spinach? Although although spinach evidently
sounds
is
like
a
Popeye on steroids,
yeah,
or something,
yeah,
right?
People like spinach, so and spinach is tricky to grow in hot weather. So perpetual spinach, I found seeds for this in one of my favorite seed catalogs, Fedco Seed and Supply Company. And,
all right, perpetual does not mean it comes back on its own.
Believe it or not, if you keep it, I moved some into the greenhouse, my basement greenhouse. It died back over the winter, and I have got the most beautiful bunch of perpetual spinach coming up again. I don't think it is a
perennial.
I just think it's a hardy thing, and it came back from its root. Because it is not spinach. It is, if you can tell by the seeds, it is in the beet family. Beet chard. It looks like beet chard, but it does not have that beet chard taste. It's really good. So perpetual spinach. It is also called, I've never seen it in any other place called perpetual spinach. It is called leaf beet. And it is good. It is a good green.
Now, it's kind of thicker than the regular spinach. The leaf is a little bit.
Think of a charred leaf.
Yeah.
That's what
it's
like.
But it's small, not like a large charred. The leaf is small like spinach.
You're thinking there's other things that are called spinach. New Zealand spinach, which is a tiny little leaf. It's very hot weather hardy, huh? There's also red Malabar spinach. Neither of these things are spinach.
Oh, something else
but
this
is, huh?
Tastes
like it. So,
all right, Lana, you're going to have to pick some and let me have a taste of it.
I'm not much on chard, but this stuff tastes really good, either raw or cooked. So look for perpetual spinach or leaf beet. So a fun thing. It's fun.
Okay, so it's not bitter like beet leaves are.
No. It is very, very mild. It is good. It is great. So looking forward to all the tastes of good stuff that is happening in the garden. Yes, it is. Speaking of spring, I'm going to read a poem here by Mary Oliver, about waking up in the spring. It's about a bear. Spring by Mary Oliver. Somewhere a black bear has just risen from sleep and is staring down the mountain. All night, in the brisk and shallow restlessness of early spring, I think of her, her four black fists flicking the gravel, her tongue like red fire touching the grass, the cold water. There is only one question: how to love this world. I think of her rising like a black and leafy ledge to sharpen her claws against the silence of the trees. whatever else my life is, with its poems, its music, its glass cities, it is also this dazzling darkness coming down the mountain, breathing and tasting. All day long I think of her, her white teeth, her wordlessness, her perfect love. Think of bears waking up, a poem by Mary Oliver. Yes, it is. Well, you mentioned asparagus. We've got lots of spring things to look forward to. Yes, we do. Oh, Dana, we've got an event coming up.
Oh, yes.
Tell folks what's
Lana
happening.
Lana and I will make a public appearance this Saturday, and we will be, Lana will be making a pie crust, her rustic tart recipe with Iowa lard and Iowa flour too, right? Early morning harvest flour, right? So we will be at the Iowa Eats Festival, which is a Silos and Smokestacks production of some sort. And, we are appearing for the Iowa Farmers Union, whom we always love to support. And so the Iowa Eats Festival is at the Waterloo Convention Center this Saturday, 11 o'clock to 5 o'clock, at all kinds of crazy food things, very Iowa-centric, and we will be there. So
yeah,
stop by and say hello if you'd like.
Yeah, so look up the Iowa, it's Iowa Eats
Festival.
Iowa Eats and Drinks and Festival. And, but they've got a nice website. They've got speakers. They also have a lot of cooking demonstrations. We're not the only ones, thank goodness.
And a lot of Iowa food products with tastings and things like that. And all kinds of entertainment.
Celebrate Iowa
especially
food.
If it's raining. It'll be something fun to do, right?
Right.
Or
right.
Snowing, right?
It might be snowing. It's inside. It's inside. Mm-hmm. So
that is this Saturday.
Good. So we'll have lots of good things to talk about on the Donna Lana Kitchen. And we also come to you not only on this fine radio station, but we have a podcast.
We do. So the Donna Lana Kitchen podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Just type in, search for Donna Lana, that's one word, DonnaLonna, second word kitchen, and we should be right there. So,
true.
Have a listen.
You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We come to you live at noon on Tuesdays on this fine radio station. We're also repeated on this radio station, 7 p.m. in the evening. Find out more at khoyfm.org. And support this radio station. We had music by the Barn Owl Band today. Earlier you heard the tune Spootiscary. I think Spootiscary must be a place name somewhere.
What?
Spootiscary.
Oh, it's the name of the song. Okay.
It's the name of the song.
Lana was speaking in tongues here all of a sudden.
We'll go out with the tune Cloud Forest, a fine waltz. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We have excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life. Mm-hmm.